But by the time we've reached this moment of the death of God, we already have a strange change in the discourse. What new games, new festivals, what could be invented now to make up for what has already been destroyed? What myths could we construct ourselves? What games? What holy festivals? What interesting books, fascinating arguments, and new ways to live, other than the pathetic, tragic, stupid, banal array of ordinary, everyday, bourgeois thinking life? Surely, we can do better than that.
Hello and welcome to the 171st episode of the Diet Soap Podcast. The guest this week is T.J. Clark. T.J. Clark is an art historian and a former member of the Situationist International. His paper, or essay, For a Left with No Future, has gotten quite a bit of attention over the last 6 months, and this essay is the subject of our discussion this week. My hero, Slavoj Žižek, has supported his essay, saying, quote, "We have to admit the grain of truth in this simplified, bleak vision which seems to snap the very possibility of a proper political event. Perhaps we should effectively renounce the myth of a great awakening, the moment when, if not the old working class, then a new alliance of the dispossessed, multitude, or whatever, will gather its forces and master decisive intervention." In my conversation with T.J. Clark, he contradicts this interpretation by Žižek, saying that he does believe in the ability of the people to make a spontaneous revolution, and yet he continues to advocate a tragic vision. It's Wednesday, February 6, 2013, well past the eschaton, and I'm Douglas Lane, the host of the Diet Soap Podcast. Okay, so the Podomatic feed is up and running again, and I'm slowly uploading the back catalog for the podcast. So you can subscribe to the podcast through my website, douglaslane.com, or through Podomatic, and you might get email alerts as I upload old podcasts. I also want to urge you to donate to Diet Soap and to tell your friends about the podcast. If you like what I'm doing, share, share, share. While I'm afraid of how dreadfully Marxist the podcast has become, I also believe that I haven't wandered away from real human concerns here. My goal for 2013 is to continue on to hold tight to the direction the podcast has found, while also returning to the sense of desperate improvisation that founded this thing. The strange moment that I'm in is this. I believe more firmly than ever in value theory and Marx's critique of capital, while I'm simultaneously convinced that we are as far away from resolving the deadlock of capitalism as we've ever been. In any case, you can find the donate button at douglaslane.com and at dietsoap.podomatic.com. In this episode, you'll hear clips from older episodes of the podcast and from Talking Art. My son Benjamin and I discussed the Arab Spring and Manet's painting Luncheon in the Grass for Diet Soap and the now-defunct 1,000 Words podcast. I'd love to revive that second effort, although editing an art podcast was very time-consuming. This conversation with T.J. Clark represents a culmination or conclusion for Diet Soap. Without meaning to, I think we've reached a turning point here. The music you're listening to is John Cage's Dream, but in just a moment you'll be listening to the art historian T.J. Clark and I discuss A Left with No Future. T.J. Clark is an art historian and writer. He has written many books, including The Painting of Modern Life, Paris and the Art of Manet and His Followers, The Sight of Death, An Experiment in Art Writing, and The Painting of Postmodern Life. T.J. Clark was also a member of the English section of the Situationist International back in the early 70s. In March of 2012, T.J. Clark's essay for the New Left Review was published. It was entitled For a Left with No Future, and this essay will be the subject for today's conversation. T.J. Clark, thank you for coming on to the Diet Soap Podcast.
It's a great pleasure. Fire away at this essay that certainly deserves some criticism.
Okay. Well, to start with, I just want to tell you that I'm really glad to have you on the show. And for me, I'm actually a little starstruck because of, your involvement with the Situationist International, but I'm going to try to fight off my pro-situ tendencies there. So.
Okay. By the way, just to clear that out of the way, there never was an English section of the Situationist International, but, never mind. It somehow or other seems to have crept in that there was something as grand and formal as an English section, but, there were some English people who were part of the group at that point. Yeah, that's what it amounted to.
In the 90s, I discovered the Situationist through Grail Marcus's book primarily.
Yeah.
And then from there I read the actual text and I've been a terrible pro-situ type for since then, consuming the image of this revolution. So I'm going to try not to ask you questions like you're a beetle and say things like, so what was Guy Debord really like and all that?
Okay.
I want to start by summarizing your essay, actually. It's an essay that really can't be summarized. It's rich and multifaceted, and it, at times for me it was challenging because I'm a reader who's maybe not familiar enough with the authors and traditions that you reference to be able to interpret what you mean easily anyway. And so I actually think that you could take if you were a professor, which I'm not, you could maybe take a semester teaching this text and still not know if you'd covered enough ground to give the students a full picture or the full texture of it.
So right.
It's very
interesting.
Yeah, it's like you've spent your whole life thinking about this, and you've written for people who have also thought about this and worked on this for their lives. And it's very mature work, so I compliment you there.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So my summary is going to be a little blunt and probably wrong, but here it is. Luckily, you're here to correct me. You seem to be arguing that we should stop hoping for a spontaneous revolution, stop believing in the inevitability of some post-capitalist world, and take a good look at everything that's gone wrong, so that we need to kind of accept the tragedy that is human nature and develop a politics that doesn't look ahead to a new human, but that is grown up enough to accept some things that can't change. So you're saying basically that we aren't self-transparent and that there's no shape to history, that history is kind of like an ink blot, and that we need to be humble enough to recognize what we can't see. And you also say that a politics, actually, I'm quoting you now, directed step by step, failure by failure, to preventing the tiger from charging out, the tiger of human violence, would be the most moderate and revolutionary politics there's ever been. So would you agree with that quick summary, and what do you think that needs to be said? What have I left out?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of it. I don't think the target is a belief in the spontaneous power of people to make revolution. I still actually believe in the in the possibility of revolutionary change. I think what I'm arguing against is more a certain determinist, historicist view of the direction and nature of historical change, and the idea of revolution being sort of seizing the logic of past and present and pushing it on towards some kind of realization in the future. All right. I mean, in a way, it's an argument against a certain classic quote Marxist unquote view. I mean, and I put the scare quotes around Marxist there because this is an immensely complex, disputed ground, and I certainly want to hold on to an awful lot of what Marx said, and I don't necessarily think that all of Marx, concurs with a view of the logic of history, right? And revolution as realizing the logic of history. It's actually that teleology and that temporality that I'm particularly have in my sights.
What you're arguing against is this notion that, this really kind of vulgar Marxist notion that immiseration itself will bring on a revolution, or that things are determined to head towards socialism, and that we, that's something you want us to give up. But it seems to me that to that extent, you may be pushing on an open door. I mean, I don't know that there are many people who hold that, at least that vulgar a sense of historical determinism anymore. And it seems as though this idea of tragedy goes a little bit beyond that. Or maybe, are we thinking that we've given this up, and when we haven't, or how, what would you say?
Yes. Well, I think that, yes, I think you're right that there are two strands in this essay. One is the idea that would it be possible for the left to modulate its whole notion of human possibility and history into something I want to call a kind of tragic key or a tragic tonality. That's one theme or one question. And the other question is, as you rightly said, the idea of an escape from a sort of orientation towards some future in which the contradictions of the present and past are resolved. There are many, that's come under many names, and revolution is only one of them, all right? But I'm wondering whether the possibility of a left politics being persuasive, carrying some kind of persuasive force in the present and future, doesn't depend on the left really bringing under relentless pressure those kind of its optimism and its orientation towards the future.
Well, it seems to me you've got two. We could talk about this in two different ways. We could talk about this in a practical sense, like whether or not such a thing as revolutionary reform is possible, and whether or not socialists of all stripes should back the right kinds of movements for reform.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's one kind of question. And
yes.
But that's not as interesting as the other kind of question, which is about tonality and about how, because I think a lot of people would recognize and agree, most, that we should do this thing about backing revolutionary reforms and not being purists. But accepting the tragedy of human nature, coming to terms with our violent tendencies, not just tendencies, but nature, again, and somehow using that recognition and to our advantage as we pick projects, understand that I think is what's most interesting about your essay to me. So could you talk about how that might be done?
Well, yes. And, I mean, one of the problems, obviously, with the essay is that it's abstract. It's very definitely about kind of premises and assumptions and the whole rhetoric of the left. I regret that abstraction. It was sort of necessary, I think, in order to kind of think my way through what seemed to me continuing obstacles, right, in the way of a reconstruction of left politics, which is what I want and we want. So let me try and answer you by just sort of moving a little bit towards the concrete. There's one point in this essay which actually you picked up in a very interesting email you sent me in advance about your own questions about the essay, which is sort of my attitude towards what's happening in Greece and the response of the Greek left to it. And I have to say that sort of looking back, of course, a lot depended on the moment when I was actually writing the essay, and I was pretty hard on on the Greek left at the moment I was writing it. I want to say that I was outpaced by events, and it seems to me wholly remarkable, you know, and a thing that the left can sort of take great qualified comfort from, right? That in the months following my writing of this this essay, the phenomenon of Syriza took place, right? And Syriza, right, there was a genuine far left coalition which contested the Greek election and did extremely well. As usual, history outpaces theory. You know, events overtake us. So let's just let me try and answer your question by thinking about the phenomenon of Syriza.
Shall I articulate the actual question I sent you so that?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so
absolutely.
You wrote that the silence of the left in Greece, for example, its inability to present a program outlining an actual persuasive default economic policy, a year-by-year vision of what would be involved in taking up the Argentine road, is indicative of the left's our own unpreparedness in the face of the economic crisis. And part of that isn't an exact quote, but that's basically what you said. And my question was, couldn't it be that the Argentine road was not an option precisely because of the pervasiveness and the systemic quality of the crisis? Argentina was able to devalue its currency and rebuild based on offering up cheap goods on the global market, whereas if Greece had devalued its currency, gone off the euro, this would have had a tremendous effect on the rest of the world, specifically the rest of Europe, and it might have been so profound that even lower prices wouldn't have resulted in any kind of ability to overcome the immiseration and crisis that would have resulted. So maybe the Argentine road wouldn't have even been an option. And
I completely agree with that. Actually, you know, this is always an annoying point in a kind of to and fro of question and answer. But in a sense, you see, that was what I was trying to imply, that the Argentine road was not open to the Greek left. The global and systemic nature of the whole European and more than European capitalist crisis just robbed them of viable, plausible left policy positions. For all the reasons you stated very very just then, you know, very eloquently. So what does the left do in a circumstance like that? It does have to settle, I think, as Syriza in the end had to settle for much more seemingly limited and political options, right? Tackling certain facts of politics, facts to do with the nature of the state it finds itself in, and facts to do with the past of that state, and the extent to which the past of that state sort of hangs heavy on the present and closes down options and makes a heck of a lot of the kind of a heck of a lot of the possibility that the left thought was there in the past of capitalism extremely remote, extremely difficult to access. So another way of saying this is that the phenomenon of Syriza is extraordinary. And it's very, very interesting, of course, that it's very, very difficult from outside Greece. I was talking to very, very, very well informed left commentator and historian the other day, and he was agreeing we're absolutely robbed of information in our usual sources about, you know, well, what is Syriza doing and what is it now proposing? It's in opposition, but it's the main opposition party. How's it evolving? What's it actually, you know, all we get is kind of spasmodic reports about Golden Dawn, the rise of fascism, and anarchist violence in the streets. That's all we get, right? You know, we don't get real information about the whole texture of Greek politics.
Well, I want to jump in and say something about about this.
Absolutely.
Here's the thing. On the one hand, I do agree that we have to be humble about what we can accomplish when we face something like what's happening in Greece. And if you're going to be a real political party who takes power in this moment, you're going to have to make allowances for the political reality that's on the ground. You just cannot avoid that. But on the other hand, I think there's been a sense in the last couple of years, especially since 2011, that maybe there would be an opportunity to work beyond that level, to work beyond the level of party politics or taking power within this system. The Arab Spring and then all of the movements through Europe and, you know, culminating in Occupy kind of gave us a sense that we were going to be at least starting a process towards a true transformation, something that would get us outside of this system. At least that was what I wanted. You know, and I admit I saw it that way because I wanted it that way. But I kind of feel like we replayed 1968 and 2011 only, you know, on the internet and TV, and we're back now facing another kind of failed attempt. Was that informing your – I mean, this is – you wrote this right around that time.
Well, I mean, it's certainly the case. It's obviously behind everything I wrote in For a Left with No Future was a sense of how extraordinary it is that you had such a colossal near catastrophe of the capitalist, of the global capitalist system, and out of it did not emerge, you know, a post-capitalist spring. Capitalism went into crisis, but sort of its institutions stabilized themselves, and the left politics, by and large, found no resonance. So that's obviously behind everything I'm saying and trying to think through. What would it take then for a left politics to have resonance, right? To, you know, to open towards a future that led us away from the same old options. Greece, I think, is still our, you know, very potent example. And what I would say about the Greek situation is that it's very, very interesting that Syriza finds itself faced by an apocalyptic right-wing alternative, right? I mean, with this horrifying name, Golden Dawn, right? The absolute epitome, right? It's about dawn is about to happen, right? Daybreak, a breakthrough into a new day, and that's the language of the apocalyptic left and the apocalyptic right. And it's that language and that set of assumptions about what radical revolutionary change might involve, what image of history and human action it might be premised on. It's that, I think, that my essay is sort of trying to dispute. So in the case of Syriza, I mean, it seems to me that Syriza got only one way to go. It has to admit the extraordinarily limited possibilities of the situation it finds itself in a state which is a Cold War leftover, rooted in the absolute misery and tragedy of civil war and of military dictatorship, and of a rampant and endemic state military upper class corruption. It has really to try to escape from the language of infinite possibility towards a kind of the grimmest possible recognition of state it's in.
Yeah, well, I don't disagree with that call for realism. I just, when your suggestion that the relationship between like a radical left apocalyptic vision and a fascist one is too narrow, and these things are too close together for your comfort, basically, and that that what needs to be abandoned is this notion of a future. And I been reading Zizek. I hate to confess that. I know that that's...
Never mind. We all have our weaknesses.
So he has suggested that, you know, that fascism is always the result of a failed left revolution, that the problem with fascism is that it doesn't really have the courage to see through its convictions and create a new day, that it always stays in the realm of capitalist production, that it's not actually outside of that. Now, I mean, that's all very simple, you know, and facile even, but is there any amount of truth to that? Are we afraid of the wrong thing here? I mean, I know you'd say we aren't, but I just wonder.
Well, I really do think that Zizek and co. are hanging on to the remnants of a certain kind of left tradition that is exactly the tradition that I sort of want to call in question. Again, to just sort of try and clarify one central move in this essay, which is completely open to dispute, but at least I sort of want to make sure it's clear what I'm saying. I don't think that a recognition of the depth of the state's crisis and the kind of extraordinary entanglement of politics in a tragic past, I don't think that means that politics is reduced to just the mere play of petty possibility. On the contrary, I think, you know, if one recognizes what the real obstacles are to change, even of the smallest and most modest sort, then it seems to me that kind of, you know, that clarifies the political field. In other words, if one realizes what it would take, for instance, in the Greek case, simply to have military expenditure, the state's military expenditure, the amount of gross national product that's absorbed by futile armament expenditure. If one realizes what would be involved in even that, which seems, you know, a fairly moderate left demand, doesn't it? If one realizes what's actually involved in sort of doing that and making that a viable political proposal, then the opposition of sort of moderate demand and revolutionary demand, I think in practice collapses. Lessening military expenditure in a time of absolute social crisis, does that sound like a revolutionary demand? No, it's a very moderate demand. It's a commonsensical demand. But as you probably know, in the Greek case, there's been absolutely no reduction of military expenditure, and the German and British and French paymasters, you know, who supply Greece with its extraordinarily inflated army and air force and all the rest of it, you know, made as a condition of so-called austerity, well, there was going to be no military austerity. So do you see what I'm saying? That I'm saying that it's open to Syriza to start making demands which seem extremely commonsensical and immediate and sort of pointing towards certain limited ways out of crisis, which immediately, actually, in practice, raise fundamental issues about the nature of the state, the nature of the state's military and capitalist involvement in a whole wider European and global state system.
One reason why making the demand to reduce military expenditures and reduce military spending in Greece would be a radical demand, is because the military is a mechanism of control that the state can use in a time of crisis. Yes. So if you're you're asking them to do is to disarm. They need that kind of direct might to control a population that's been immiserated.
Yeah, absolutely right. You know, I've been very, very interested in, in the months since writing the essay in, for instance, in the example of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament and the Committee of 100 in Britain in the 1950s and 60s. Very interested because, again, at the time, many on the left said, well, this is a very limited, it's not raising the question of state power and the capitalist system. Of course, it actually, looking back, it seems as close to a truly successful left movement as Britain ever got, post-1945. There were various moments at which it really looked as though it was going to break the structure of parliamentary left politics, and there was frantic mobilization on the part of, the party parliamentary system to contain it and marginalize it. And so it seems to me that once again, I think we're in a situation in which the question of capitalism and the capitalist state can be raised again, but it's a question of, well, how can it be raised? Where are its weak points? Where are its obvious excesses? What should we go for? Right, I mean, that's what I meant in the essay by saying the question of capitalism with a big C, the huge question of capitalism, at the moment is just a sort of rhetorical flourish, really, right? It's not a real politics. What we should be looking for is the question of what we should be looking for is a facet of the capitalist state that could be made political again in terms which might resonate with the wider population. And I certainly think that, the military-industrial complex and the extraordinary continuing, acceleration of military expenditures and the whole imbrication of politics and the military, that's still a possible ground for political action on the left.
The Renaissance painter developed a whole strategy for how to create a sense of three-dimensionality on a canvas.
Right.
And this painting violates that sense. Specifically, the woman bathing in the background is too large. She's out of proportion for where she should be if we had the proper depth of field.
Supposed to be far away?
She's supposed to be well behind them. She's, if you look at the boat, for instance, along the same river, that boat is smaller than she is, and yet they're about the same distance away.
Well, it looks like that's supposed to, where she is about to be just a few feet away, and the boat is supposed to be further.
The boat is in the same river.
Yeah.
It is running along the horizon, and so the pond or river along the horizon kind of defines a certain distance. She's far larger than she ought to be. So that was one of the things that critics really focused on at the time. Like, this painting is absurd. This painter doesn't know how to paint. This woman is well out of proportion. The other thing that they notice is that it was, in some way, a version of this painting, The Outdoor Party.
It's kind of similar.
They depict the same kind of outdoor party. They've got two naked women and clothed men there. Yeah, that's a good question. Why is the woman naked in The Luncheon on the Grass? Manet is following the tradition of the nude. The critic John Berger would point out that the Western tradition of the nude in art is a patriarchal tradition. It treats women as objects and their sexuality as something for men. So it's no surprise that in that kind of tradition, if there's going to be a nude, it will be a woman, and that if men are in the same frame with her, then they'll be clothed.
In the nudes of European painting, we can discover some of the criteria and conventions by which women were judged. We can see how women were seen. What then is a nude? In his book on the nude, Kenneth Clark says that being naked is simply being without clothes. The nude, according to him, is a form of art. I would put it differently. To be naked is to be oneself. To be nude is to be seen naked by others and yet not recognized for oneself. A nude has to be seen as an object in order to be a nude.
I want to shift the question a little bit, or the ground for the questioning a little bit now, because here's the reason why. When you talk about, saying, disarming the state in a moment of crisis, that is a radical thing to do, but it won't be revolutionary unless the people thus unshackled have something they want to do, other way to live. And otherwise, you might risk a return of the military apparatus, you know, that's populist. You know, people's like, I can't take this. Come back. So I want to ask you about painting, and I've read your book about Manet. The question of Manet's painting and of modernism might have some bearing here. This is really simplistic, and you know, I'm well out of my league here asking you this, but here it goes. Okay, so. You know, in the Renaissance, paintings had depth. There was a vanishing mediator. They had a certain perspective, a three-dimensional perspective. This is how people who knew how to paint, painted.
Yes.
Manet comes along, and he emphasizes the flatness of his canvas. He goes against that perspective of the three-dimensional and the vanishing mediator and paints in a new way. And what seems to come out of that is pure painting, painting that is not anything but itself, right? I mean, that's at least what people end up aiming at.
Some do.
Right.
Yeah.
Some do. And it seemed to be at least logical that they would once you break that perspective. And what I'm wondering is if we still need to develop some sort of a perspective that might not be the same one that we had before, that would break with the one we're in now, but that would be the next step. In other words, and that's a kind of a temporal idea that you know, you go from one perspective in painting to another perspective, not to this multiplicity and pure plural kind of plurality of just the real canvas.
So
that's what I want to make political here, too, is saying, look, we need to develop something that we believe in that will give us depth again, or give us some sort of not turning to a fascist perspective where we're just going to paint like they used to, but just a new kind of perspective. And that's that's the avant-garde tradition that I'm advocating.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting, actually. I never thought of this idea of, you know, there being an analogy between historical thinking and perspectival painting practice. But of course there is. Of course there is. And I would say that, of course, what the 20th century avant-garde said was the problem with perspective. And this included, by the way, you know, many movements that saw themselves absolutely as revolutionary and committed to a revolutionary politics, right? The constructivists in Russia, De Stael in the Netherlands, and so on. What they often said about perspective was that the problem with perspective was that the vanishing point, the all-seeing eye, right, the single-pointedness of perspective, And what they wanted instead was a kind of a pulling back of the seeing of the world onto the surface, an admission that all points of view were contingent and partial and temporary, because they thought that opened the possibility of criticism, right? Admitting the incomplete and disputable nature of all representations, and they thought that was the picture of what representation ought to be that went alongside revolutionary political discourse, right, which was going to be an open field for proposal, counter-proposal, dispute, dialectic, all right? I mean, they wanted perspective to be replaced by a fully dialectical means of representation. And I suppose you're right. I mean, I really had not thought of this analogy before you proposed it, that in some sense I'm on their side in this, all right? I mean, you know, I want the left to give up the perspective of history and think again about the actual sort of discursive to and fro and incompleteness of real politics.
You know, I'm very sympathetic to that way of thinking, and I'm not sure what's wrong with it, really. But I feel as though maybe there's a vanishing mediator that really has vanished that we don't see,
yeah.
And that's capitalism. And that as long as we think that we have developed a view that's truly flat and transparent, and everything's right there in front of us on the canvas, and we don't, and we're unable to see the vanishing mediator because it's vanished, then we're not going to be able to develop real liberation, you know,
yes.
True dialectical
yes.
liberation. So,
well, I absolutely agree with your worry about that. I mean, look, I'm not, you know, my critics will say of me, and they've already, you know, another kind of critic will say of me, and they've already been saying it. And of course, well, it's still capitalism for you, isn't it? That is the all determinant reality, and that you're trying to somehow or other find a way of, you know, facing it at the moment of its crisis, but it's sort of all-encompassing determination. And they're right. I mean, of course, I absolutely, because I say that the question of capitalism in practice does not seem to be made political, or, you know, it doesn't seem to be capable of being made political in the present circumstances. That doesn't mean that I don't think the question of capitalism isn't the overriding one. It is. It is. So what I'm talking about, I think, is, well, within this all-encompassing reality, where do we go, right? What are the weak points? How do we act on it, within it, take its measure, really contest it, you know, effectively, not just rhetorically? That's my question. I mean, but it's directed to the same old reality.
I appreciate that. I think we're both. I mean, what's really nice about living today, actually, is that I'm able to have this conversation with you about this, and, you know, even though there's a disagreement, we can work it out. And I think that is at least is a hopeful thing. But I feel at this moment we're like in the thicket of it. You know, I don't have a clear way to ask you the next question that's going to just move it along, and maybe that supports your position. There's no temporality.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that one of the most interesting things that was said to me by one reader, very dear friend of mine, and certainly certainly a person of, you know, the far left. And he said to me, you know, well, I suppose what you're doing in this essay is asking me and others like me, all right, well, how much of what I took to be basic to a left-wing position has to be called into question now, given this extraordinary situation we're in which capitalism is truly in crisis, but left politics doesn't seem to be able to frame a response to it that carries any weight, any resonance. So how deep has our reconstruction got to go?
Yeah, I'm going to be daring here and tell you, I think I have felt in the last few years, since 2008, when the economic crisis has come along, that it might be possible to find out how deep that it needs to go, and that I have become more Marxist since 2008 rather than less. I'm someone who read a lot of anarchist theory and Chomsky and the Situationists, and now have become enamored with the Marxist Humanist Initiative and the idea of value theory and all of that. And so I feel that a return to Marx right now might be really helpful, not the return to this vulgar Stalinism, but return to Marx's value theory. And I worry that when people say, oh, we need to get away from this temporality, this idea of any kind of meta narrative, that they're going to miss out on actually finding what they say they're looking for. And maybe that's very, you know, sectarian of me to say, but
no, I don't think it's sectarian at all. I mean, I think you're pointing to a real danger, and I don't think, you know, look, on the one hand, as another friend of mine said, when he came reeling out of a fairly recent, you know, Marxist conference, well, there's a certain kind of gloating. Oh, capitalism at last has revealed itself to be in crisis, you know, and right, you know, well, gloating is not in order, right? You know, given no. the absolute misery that people are experiencing. But of course, in a sense, you know, we are in a capitalist crisis again, and a tremendous amount of Marxist theory and Marxist attitudes are sharply relevant. It's which particular descriptions and prescriptions are relevant, and what sort of overarching mythology of historical action has to be abandoned, right? That's my question.
We've been talking for about 40 minutes here, and I think we've done really well, and I think
okay.
thank you very much for the opportunity. Is there anything that we didn't talk about, or that I sent you a bunch of questions and then really didn't ask you any of them, but I felt like they set the tone.
Yeah, well, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's, you know, you asked me a very opening, very tough philosophical question about whether letting go of the future capitulates to a certain kind of dreadful, hallucinated, estranged presentness, you know, in which you leave go of a human capacity to sort of live in time and take time seriously. This is a huge philosophical question, right? You know, and of course it does lurk there in the background. And I was, you know, I've been thinking about an answer to it. There's no simple answer to it. I just think I certainly think that it's basic to the human to live in time, to live with the notion of past, present, and future. That's different. What I'm arguing against is the modern idea that a true living in time is a living that's always oriented towards the future. The future is what counts. The future is what will make the present and the past bearable. You know, this seems to me, it's just actually a kind of it's a modernized version of religious thinking for me. You know, that there will be an end to suffering and all shall be well. And I think that what we should be thinking about is, you know, escaping from this false orientation towards the future and taking the present seriously, facing the present, facing present possibilities and impossibilities. You know, and I don't think that means that we're sort of living in a completely sort of vacuous, two-dimensional here and now. It's just a different view of time. That's all.
Well, I think that there's a lot of thinking still to be done about what you wrote and about this issue. And I do agree with quite a bit of what you're saying. I'm just a little hesitant here and there, and specifically about giving up on not some preordained vision of utopia. I mean, I have Jehovah's Witnesses come to my house and tell me about that all the time, and I try to get rid of them.
They're real.
This yeah. idea that we could make something new that wouldn't necessarily be ordained or, you know, predestined, but that we could do. And I just have one other question for you, and then I'll let you go, which is how would you characterize the reaction to your essay? It seemed to me that this got a lot of traction, that you really did poke at something that people were feeling and thinking about, and that you got a lot of people discussing this essay. Would you agree that that...
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, you never quite know, right? And it's such a strange kind of world, this virtual world we now live in, right? You know, it means you get actually a lot of individual reactions, but you're not quite sure what that means. You know, it has interested me a lot that a young Israeli leftist has just translated it, and it's going to come out in Israel. That'll be very interesting to sort of see a reaction to it there. And it's about to be, later in the year, it will be published as a small book in Brazil. Even more extraordinary, actually, you know, the idea that in Brazil, you know, which is, after all, you know, has had a kind of left regime, and, you know, and subscribing in many ways to a kind of Marxist politics, and does go on thinking of itself as a young nation with the future before. Very, very interesting that they're, you know, they're taking this seriously enough to think it worth publishing as a book. So, yeah, I mean, something's happening. I mean, it won't surprise you to hear that, it divided the editorial board of New Left Review, and there are people on the board of New Left Review who absolutely thought they shouldn't publish it at all, you know. So it's the left we're talking about.
right. Well, thank you again. It was an honor. And before I go, what was Guy Debord really like?
He was a very extraordinary man, of course. And what shall I say about Guy? I mean, he immensely charming and unpredictable and intense. And as I once or twice have said to people, of course you understand this was sort of 1966, 67, kind of strange things were happening. You know, everything seemed to be in free flow. And it was an object lesson, actually, in being in a kind of revolutionary group and seeing the power of a leader figure. You know, everyone knowing that that carried with it immense dangers, right? And in some sense, it was very much contrary to, you know, the stated sort of ideas and ideals of the group. But it was very, very, that in what we kind of thought was a pre-revolutionary situation, you do get this extraordinary experience of, you know, that at moments that matter, an awful lot depends on the power of a leading individual. very much to be distrusted, and a lot, you know, and everybody was aware of that and talking about it, and you know, trying to keep it, to some extent, a distance from the force field, including him in a way, right? You know, and there was a side of him which didn't want to be the leader. But it was a very, very interesting and, as you'll gather, unforgettable, you know, experience of what the dynamics of revolutionary politics really is like, you know, when push comes to shove.
Well, I recommend your books to people who are listening, and I thank you again, and I will let you know when this has been edited.
Okay, Doug. Yeah, I very much appreciate your question. It's a great pleasure to talk.
Okay, so let's try to make this more kind of seem more real.
Okay.
So to do that, I'm going to make it simpler. And the person I'm going to quote is Mr. Rogers.
All right.
Did you ever wonder how crayons were made? I've often thought about people making crayons. I'll do some more of this later, but I'd like to show you some people making crayons.
Mr. Rogers says that, you know, people make things.
Mm-hmm.
So he points out to the kids that watch his program or watched it when it was on. I guess he's dead.
I think they still show reruns.
Okay. Well, he points out then still in virtual reality where he still lives. he points out that... crayons, bass violins, houses, Twinkies, all this stuff in our lives. It doesn't just come into existence on its own, but people make it.
Why do you think of bass violins and Twinkies?
I think these are things that he talked about.
Oh.
Like, I think he went to a Twinkie factory and he went to a bass violin factory.
Like colored flowers.
Really, a bass violin factory?
Yeah, yeah. So,
a factory where they particularly make bass violins.
Yeah. Anyway, Lefebvre would say that not only do people make things, but they make the space that those things occupy. You know, that sounds like Minecraft again, right?
Yeah.
But it isn't really that mystical. Let me give you an example that I think I can elaborate and make it clear. The think about a television set.
Uh-huh.
A television set is something people make, but in order to make that set, first, what had to have happened is that the space for the television set to occupy had to have been created. And let me tell you how that was done. Let's go all the way back to ancient Rome. Julius Caesar, when he wanted to inform citizens about things that were important to him, he ordered that posters be produced and displayed on white boards in cities and villages throughout his empire. Now, in order for that to come to be, those posters to come to be, there had to have been an empire. There had to have been Julius Caesar. There had to have been an army to go out and build these white boards. And there had to have been people that Julius Caesar could say, hey, make these posters. And there had to have been
people
who were citizens of the empire to read them and think they were important. So the Roman Empire itself was the space that had to have been created in order for these posters to be created.
But,
right?
Space. So Julius Caesar's empire was the space?
Yeah, that was the created space which allowed for these posters to be made.
So you're not literally talking about space or like the absence of something then?
Well, I'm no longer conceiving of space as an absence of something. It is instead something that is produced.
Okay.
The key question may still be left out in this description, but just to go on a little bit further, later on, about 1,500 years later, after Julius Caesar, this German guy, Johannes Gutenberg, invented the printing press.
By means of printing, the fund of knowledge accumulated through the ages is available to everyone, rich and poor alike. Printing is essential to all education. All the other arts rely on it. Religious movements depend on it. Business could not function without it, nor could government. Because of the need for printed matter in practically all of man's activities, printing now ranks fourth among the nation's great industries. The wide variety of products of the press and the demand for a constant supply requires the efforts of many skilled persons, in printing firms ranging in size from the small one-man establishment to large plants employing hundreds of workers.
So flashing forward to today, we have radio and television and the internet and our industrial
and
technological society.
The printing press created the space for those?
The history from then till now created the space for those, and the invention of democracies, the creation of industrial capitalist systems of production, the factory system, the move away from rural America as the dominant place where things were made in our culture to urban environments where things were made in factories and technologically. Yeah. All of this created the space for radio and television and internet technologies to become dominant. Actually, radio worked really well for a more rural, kind of came to be in a rural America. Point here is that you can see that the space for technology is socially produced economically and socially in lots of different ways. Then just to make this point even more concrete, let's turn back to Egypt and Tunisia. Social media like Facebook and Twitter were vitally important tools that were employed by young, dissatisfied workers and citizens in those countries. So the extent that these strikes and protests managed to change Egyptian society, this is the extent to which those tools might be said to have played a role in changing Egyptian society. What that means is that the space is created for those tools that then can go on and alter the actual space that they occupy.
Right. The way, like, the objects that are in the space are interacting with the space and the production of it. It's kind of what I was saying with the printing press, is that it helped produce more space.
Yeah. It get a more informed citizens. They want more and more things. They have new ideas about what their role should be in society based on the space that's already produced and the newspapers and books that are coming to them. So spreading literacy basically spreads more demands for democracy and participation. And this is the theory here. It's kind of an Enlightenment theory. It's this kind of idea that history is being driven towards more and more democracy, more and more freedom, and better forms of representation.
I hope you forgive me for saying this, but I think that's weak. I think it's not just about representation and self-representation. I think that in some ways aestheticizes what it's about. I think this is a struggle for getting a meal on the table day to day. It's a struggle for having a job. It's a struggle to get justice. It's a struggle not to be beaten up by the cops or by the army.
I had a friend once who told me that the worst mistake that you can make is to think that you are alive, when really you're asleep in life's waiting room. The trick is to combine your waking rational abilities with the infinite possibilities of your dreams. Because if you can do that, you can do anything. Did you ever have a job that you hated, worked really hard at? A long, hard day work, finally you get to go home, get in bed, close your eyes, and immediately you wake up and realize that the whole day at work had been a dream. Bad enough that you sell your waking life for minimum wage, but now they get your dreams for free.
Maybe we should turn away from the movie for a minute, because really in Egypt and in the United States, we're not really discussing a movie of our lives. We're discussing our lives. If it's true that this could apply at all, what is it that produces the spaces that we occupy? It's not a novelist or even a filmmaker. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So who is it that produces the spaces we occupy every day?
Is it us?
Well, it might be. I would say that the answer is given to us by Mr. Rogers, the people, but a certain kind of people that Mr. Rogers never really indicates. It's the working classes. They're the ones who produce the spaces that are.
He talks to working class.
He does. He talks to working class people, but he doesn't define them as working class.
No.
So it's not just people who make things, but working class people who make things. And that's what's erased from this movie, Stranger Than Fiction, are working class people.